Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Canada is sending military advisors to Iraq to help in the fight against a terrorist group ISIS, and NATO has approved a rapid response team for Eastern Europe that will create a military front in countries along the Russian border. McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru joins us to break down Canada's commitments and what they mean for our country.
With just over a week to go until MPs return to the House of Commons, NDP leader Thomas Mulcair sits down with McLean's political editor Paul Wells for discussion about his party's plans for the fall and the lead-up to the 2015 election.
Speaking of the next vote, the economy is going to be one of the big issues for the government, and fittingly, Finance Minister Joe Oliver joins McLean's Anne Kingston for a one-on-one talk about job creation, the housing market, income splitting, and how he faces ageism in politics.
And we sit down with the premiers for Ontario, BC, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba to discuss interprovincial trade, missing and murdered Aboriginal women, and who is absent from last week's Council of the Federation.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. This week, Prime Minister Stephen Harper made his way to the NATO summit in Wales for what was being called one of the most important meetings in the organization's history. Not only was the ongoing crisis in Ukraine on the agenda, but also the growing threat of ISIS.
The United States held a series of sideline meetings to create a coalition of countries willing to take on this terrorist organization that has been operating out of Syria and northern Iraq. ISIS has beheaded two American journalists and is holding a British citizen hostage. A new Amnesty International report also says ISIS has been involved in ethnic cleansing with widespread murder of religious minorities in the region.
At the end of the two-day summit, Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced Canada would be helping in the fight against this Islamic extremist group.
Based on the assessment of needs on the ground, President Obama has requested a commitment of Canadian military advisors. In response to this request, Cabinet has authorized the deployment of several dozen members of the Canadian Armed Forces. These personnel will work with their U.S. counterparts who are assisting and advising Kurdish forces in northern Iraq. Following final sign-off from the government of Iraq, Canadian personnel will be positioned for an initial period of up to 30 days. This commitment will be reassessed at that time. This is not a combat mission, and our role is clearly defined. Canada is joining our allies in providing critical advice to forces in northern Iraq as they continue to hold back the terrorist advance.
Meanwhile, NATO also announced it would be taking action to deal with the ongoing crisis in Eastern Europe. As Ukraine and Russia confirmed that they were signing a ceasefire deal, the NATO allies agreed to set up a rapid response force called Spearhead. Thousands of troops would be stationed in Baltic states, which fear that they could be targets of Russian aggression. The troops would be ready to take action within 48 hours if necessary.
To talk more about what these initiatives mean for Canada, we're joined by McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru, who has worked in the Middle East and was in Ukraine earlier this year as Russian troops entered Crimea.
Thanks for having me.
So first off, what exactly do you think our soldiers will be doing on the ground in Iraq?
Well, it's very curious. They are allegedly going to be from, at least partly from, the Special Operations Regiment. And according to the White House, for example, among other reports, they will be deployed to help the Kurdish forces who are in the north of Iraq and are really on the forefront of the fight against the Islamic State, formerly the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. But according to the CBC, they will be located in Baghdad. So that really raises the question of what exactly they might be doing that is useful if they are allegedly advising tactical and giving tactical and strategic advice to the Kurds in the north of Iraq. They presumably don't speak Kurdish, but are going to be in Baghdad. It's curious to know how effective that would be, beyond perhaps an admittedly important symbolic signal that this is a fight that Canada considers its own and wants to make a visible contribution to.
How obviously this is being sold as sort of advisory and assistance in that regard, not necessarily a combat mission. But how real are the risks here? How much danger are we putting our soldiers in?
Well, many parts of Iraq are an active combat zone, and I think given the political fallout that might would likely arise from any sort of fatality of Canadian soldiers in Iraq, I think that our forces there will be as safe as possible. I don't expect that they will be anywhere near the front line. I mean, that said, unforeseen events happen. So we saw this even in Afghanistan after the official end of our combat mission there. I mean, there are road accidents, there are potential suicide bombings. I mean, it is a dangerous part of the world, but I expect that the risks will be, as Prime Minister Harper said, low.
So after about 30 days in Iraq, the government is going to reassess the mission and see where to go from there. But the Prime Minister as well, speaking at the NATO summit, said that our partners, our allies in this, are going to be planning out the next steps. And I guess the question is this just the start of a larger military initiative in Iraq to take down the ISIS terrorist group?
Well, I hope so. I mean, if you recall several months ago, U.S. President Barack Obama likened it to a junior varsity team wearing a professional basketball sweater. Clearly, it's much more than that. And America's own language, as ISIS has grown in its strength and also in its cruelty, has gone from containing, that ISIS must be contained, to rolled back, to now Barack Obama says it must be dismantled. I think this reflects just the really horrendous advance that ISIS has made, the cruelties it's inflicted on religious and ethnic minorities, to say nothing of also Sunni Muslims themselves, as is ISIS. And also its coherence. I mean, this is not a junior varsity terrorist organization, as Obama dismissed it. Not so long ago, new information is coming out about its sophistication. It is a proto-state, and it is trying to establish itself as a proto-state with laws and hierarchies. It was even the other day giving out traffic tickets. So it has ambitions. It contains hundreds of recruits from Western countries, and the fear, of course, that those recruits will return to their homes in the West, including in Canada, and possibly attack targets here. And you combine this with this just what unfortunately will, and I hope not, but will likely continue, this regular gruesome murder of Western hostages. And I think this has really changed the calculation of Western leaders regarding the extent to which ISIS must be confronted.
Meanwhile, separately, we have Canada and NATO grappling with the Russia-Ukraine conflict and the threat that Russia poses and the rebels pose in eastern Ukraine. What role do you see NATO playing now, and what role do you see Canada playing within that?
As far as it comes to Ukraine, I think no meaningful role. I think our interventions are symbolic. That we are very keen to express our solidarity with Ukraine, and we're very reluctant to do anything to demonstrate that. Having a few exercises in Western Ukraine, far from the actual fighting with Russia, isn't going to change anything. This spearhead brigade that is being launched or developed now, I mean, again, this is a symbolic message to Russia that NATO is recommitting itself to the original purposes of the organization. And I think Barack Obama made a very good speech in Estonia the other night, underlining that as well, that the United States, which really is the military backbone of the alliance, remains committed to Article 5, which says that an attack on one is an attack on all, and will defend every NATO ally. He was very clear there are no junior allies. This was a specific message to the Baltic states. So I think NATO has made a symbolic reaffirmation of its commitment to collective defense. But that doesn't include Ukraine. Ukraine is out of the club and is very much on its own, or meaningfully on its own. I mean, again, night vision goggles, medical kits, sleeping bags. I mean, these things are not going to turn the tide against the Russian army, which I think is why we've seen the ceasefire, because Ukraine is in a position of weakness and I think is grappling with the reality that it's not going to be in a strong position now that Russia has committed to confronting it with force.
You were in Ukraine not too long ago. Are you surprised that it's gotten to this point? Do you think there's anything that could have been done between then and now to have prevented this sort of situation that we have now?
I think that if NATO was willing to go to war over Ukraine, then that might have changed Putin's calculations. But that was never the case. I mean, right from the beginning, Vladimir Putin believed that the stakes in Ukraine were higher for Russia than NATO and the NATO countries perceive them to be for itself. And he was right. Putin was willing to risk war over Crimea. He's willing to go to war over eastern Ukraine now. Russian soldiers are coming home and being surreptitiously buried in coffins. And this is causing some disquiet in Russia. But these are the sort of losses that Putin is perfectly willing to absorb that Western nations are not. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure if there's ever a moment of that if the West had shown stronger resolve. One could arguably say that they should have had harsher sanctions earlier on. I think I would support that argument, and I would support the same argument that we need a harsher response now. I think France should do more than just suspend, for example, the delivery of these amphibious assault ships. But the bottom line is for Vladimir Putin, Ukraine is much dearer to his perception of Russian strength, and he is willing to sacrifice more and risk more and absorb more losses than the West is. And I think, sadly, I think that doesn't bode well for Ukraine's future vis-a-vis the rest of Europe and its neighbor to the east.
Well, you said Ukraine was pretty much on its own in dealing with Russia in this conflict. We've seen NATO build up its presence in the surrounding states. For Canada, do you see much more military activity in those surrounding states? If so, how? And then how much of a real threat is Russia to those other countries?
The hard thing about trying to predict what Russia might do next is nobody really knows. I mean, I've said this before. I was in Ukraine. I was in Crimea when Russia invaded, and it was unfolding before my eyes, and I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that Russia would tear up a treaty that it had signed only after the Cold War. It had committed itself to the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and then invaded and annexed Crimea. Until I saw it, I couldn't have believed it. And similarly, I mean, prior to this crisis, I think few people would have predicted that Russia would have invaded a European country. So no one really knows how far Putin will go. I mean, certainly people that watch this believe that threats to, say, Estonia, for example, are not beyond the realm of possibility. Putin has declared that he has the right and indeed the obligation to protect Russian ethnic Russians outside of Russia, and there are ethnic Russians all over Eurasia. I mean, so I think this is a very worrying possibility, and I don't, unfortunately, think it's unrealistic in the way that I suspect a lot of people would have considered it only a year ago.
And Canada's military presence in the region, do you think that might increase?
I think it should. I think Canada is part of NATO. We have a solemn commitment to our NATO allies, and we need to back that up. I don't think this is something that we can honorably shirk from.
All right, Michael, thank you so much for your thoughts today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Maclean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru for his take on Canada's military commitments from this week's NATO meeting in Wales.
Still to come on the show, NDP leader Thomas Mulcair talks about his party's plan leading up to the next election, Finance Minister Joe Oliver discusses job creation, the housing market, and ageism, and we hear from the premiers of Ontario, BC, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we have a one-on-one with Finance Minister Joe Oliver, and we get a few premiers to weigh in on a variety of issues from interprovincial trade to missing and murdered Aboriginal women. But first,
MPs will be heading back to the House of Commons in just over a week's time. With an election coming up next year, all parties will be fighting tooth and nail for your vote over the coming months.
But the official opposition seems to be in a tough spot. The NDP will not only be fighting the Conservative government, but it will also be trying to hold off the third-place Liberals, who have surged under leader Justin Trudeau and are polling ahead of all other parties. So what's the new Democrat plan heading into the next vote, and how will they do battle with foes on both sides of the House? NDP leader Thomas Mulcair discusses these issues with Maclean's political editor Paul Wells.
Tom Mulcair, thanks for joining us.
Great to see you, Paul.
You are off to Edmonton for your National Caucus retreat. And then I have this image of every MP vanishing into a chute. And when they come out at the end of it, there'll be a new Prime Minister, or the one we've got now. Mm-hmm. Is this essentially a pre-electoral session of Parliament?
No question. Everything that the government's going to be doing for the next year, everything that we're going to be doing in opposition, has one objective in mind, forming the government. All of us are trying to do the same thing. We'd love, for the first time in Canadian history, to have an NDP government, and that's what we're working towards.
What are you going to do to achieve that?
We're going to keep putting substantive things on the table, which we started doing just over a year ago when Mr. Harper announced without having ever told anyone in advance that this is something he'd been thinking of. He went to Davos, Switzerland, and said, oh, by the way, Canadians now have to work till age 67 to get their pension. So I remember the 2011 campaign, and Stephen Harper never mentioned that to Canadians. So that was something that he had kept to himself. So we're going to call him out on that and say, what else is he hiding if he ever gets reelected? And by the way, the NDP will roll that back from 67 to 65. We've already started to talk about making sure that if there is a surplus, we'll avoid the reduction in the transfers that the Conservatives have already announced. Remember, Mr. Flaherty, no discussion, no debate, it wasn't even on the agenda, simply announced to the provinces and territories that there would be as much as $36 billion less transferred to the provinces than what had been under the current financing scheme. And we're saying, if you have a surplus, it's a fake surplus because you're planning that cut, make sure it goes over to health care as a priority. Governing is about your priorities. This fall, you'll hear us talk about child care. I've been going across Canada, listening to parents, talking with provincial authorities. We're going to be in places as diverse as Southern Ontario and Iqaluit talking about child care. It's a big issue for us. It's something I worked on a lot in Quebec City. You'll hear us also, and we're going to talk about this a great deal, the Liberals got rid of the federal minimum wage the last time we were in power. You're going to hear us talking about that as well this fall.
Okay. Straight up then, how are you going to get the revenues for your spending promise?
Well, unlike the Liberals who say that they're not going to touch anything, we've been clear since the beginning that the only Canadians who aren't paying their fair share are Canadian corporations. They've had their tax level drop down way below the OECD average, way below what the Americans are paying. And, you know, when you realize that you're able to make that money thanks to a court system and the police and education and infrastructure, all the things that cost the general public a lot through their taxes, well, corporations who are using all of that to make the money and the benefits and the profits that they make, they should be paying their fair share. We're not shy about that. There's a great group in England called the Tax Justice Network we've been working with. This is an issue that's being discussed across the OECD. Mr. Harper doesn't believe in it. We do.
Are you anticipating substantial revenues from any kind of carbon pricing mechanism?
We're going to have revenues because there is going to be a price on carbon, and that money is going to be paid over immediately for purposes that have to do with the environment. In other words, Canada will become a major player in green renewables. You know, by 2020, and this is the federal government's own number, the world market per year in green renewable technologies will be $2 trillion. Canada's not a player, certainly not a major player. We have a few companies, but we're not playing a major role because we have a government that doesn't believe that the state has a role. We think that that's the key to creating the next generation of well-paid jobs in our country.
You're talking about a substantial increase in health transfers over what the Conservatives have planned. Would you ask for some kind of deal in return from the provinces?
You know, it's not that hard. Having been in provincial politics, if you do it right, you can get the best practices on the table and simply share with it. There are some people for many years have said, well, the federal government should be doing this to require XYZ of the provinces. Don't forget, the federal government is itself a major health care provider. It provides about 20% of the health care in Canada when you add together veterans, penitentiaries, veterans, penitentiaries, and First Nations. That across the country, that works out to quite a few people. I think that maybe some of the federal government's practices are worth copying, but overall, I don't know if it has that many lessons to give to the provinces and territories. Since he became Prime Minister, Mr. Harper has refused to meet even once with the Council of the Federation. They just had a very good meeting out in Charlottetown. You can't run a country like Canada if you're not talking with your partners. I come out of provincial politics. I'm not afraid of sitting down with provincial politicians and territorial politicians. We've undertaken to have two meetings a year of the Council of the Federation, one in Ottawa and one in one or other of the provinces or territories on a rotating basis. It's not that bad. You can actually talk about things like healthcare, but even a subject like the environment is not exclusive to the federal government or the provincial governments. You have to work together on these issues.
Would a Prime Minister Tom Mulcair show up at one of these Council of the Federation meetings with a proposal to abolish the Senate? And how would he do on that day?
Well, I've been doing that for a couple of years now. I've been going across the country, whether it's meeting with Premier Giz in Prince Edward Island, and a lot of people told me, well, that's going to be one of the tougher ones because the number of seats that they have in Parliament is tied to the number of senators that they have. But he was quite clear with me. He's not going to fight to keep senators. You know, every province that had a second chamber has abolished it. He does want to make sure that he keeps his four MPs, and that wouldn't be a hard deal to make. I'd go across the country, I'd talk to the provinces, I'd try to get everyone on board. We sincerely believe that in this day and age, having this simile House of Lords dictating to the elected what they can and can't do is an absurdity. All the Nordic countries have unicameral legislatures. We can develop bodies within that to make sure that there's a good equilibrium, that there's checks and balances. But the Senate, unelected, is simply not part of it. We would get rid of it purely and simply, and we would work with the provinces and territories to do that. By the way, go to any province. Go to Nova Scotia. Ask if anyone's pining for the return of their Senate. Go to Quebec City. It's a lovely meeting room. And in the House of Commons, of course, we think the Senate would make the ideal daycare.
Okay. For about a year now, the Conservatives have been running private radio ads against Justin Trudeau and his marijuana policy. Spent about $1 million on that. They have run far fewer ads against Tom Mulcair and the NDP. Do you feel left out?
Well, I mean, I'll let the Conservatives make their evaluations. They're pretty smart politicians, by the way, and they have loads and loads of cash, because to be able to put those ads on the air between elections means that they're sitting on tons of dough. They obviously consider it a good investment. I wouldn't put my money on that. The campaign itself might wind up being a pretty rough and tumble. We'll deal with it. We're all in politics.
Is it frustrating to to ask at least 5 questions a day, a question period, to travel the countries as avidly as you do, and to see for 16 consecutive months the Liberal Party leading in the polls?
You know, what's going to happen a year from now is people are going to be voting to determine who can actually run the government and who's going to be able to lead a G7 country. And I think that the concentration around that issue, as people do want change, is going to lead a lot of people to the NDP. I've always understood that the NDP is always going to have to fight for every column inch. You know, we're not going to get people spontaneously running to find out every detail of the way they tend to pay attention to one of the other leaders. But frankly, we're going to continue fighting. I mean, I do have the well-deserved reputation of being a strong fighter, and it comes with, one, coming from a family of 10 kids, but two, coming out of Quebec City, which is a very bare-knuckles political environment to earn your stripes in. And I bring that fight, but to issues that are important to us in the NDP and have always identified us, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for better wages, fighting to make sure that families have a better shake in the current economy where a lot of those good-paying jobs are lost. Fighting so that people can keep their pensions if their company goes bankrupt or becomes insolvent. We're the only ones who talk about that, and we're going to continue doing that.
Okay. I think one of the conservative calculations is that in the next campaign you'll stop turning all your attention on the government, and you'll turn a good measure of your attention on Trudeau and the Liberals.
My attention is on Stephen Harper and his Conservatives. The Conservative policies of Stephen Harper are hurting the country that I know and love.
Okay. You're taking on a little flack as you go. You've just lost the Member of Parliament who says that in seeking to moderate the NDP line on the conflict in the Middle East, you're too soft on Israel.
Well, don't forget, I mean, my position is identical to Jack's. Two-state solution, a safe, secure state for Israelis within mutually agreed borders, a safe, secure state for Palestinians within mutually agreed borders. There's no question that some people would like to see us take a far different approach, but I think that a fair-minded approach is what Canadians expect from their leadership. For me, it's always been a very clear issue that Israel has to be given its right to exist, the ability to defend itself. I don't think any fair-minded person can be opposed to that. The person who left was opposed to that, and I'll let her explain what her position was when she ran for election. I know what Jack's and mine was and what the party's was.
Should the party that wins the largest number of seats at the next election form the next government?
Yes, the party that forms the next government is the party that has the largest number of seats. That's our constitutional order.
Okay. And then, so let me test it with a hypothetical. Does that, even if it's the NDP, or if it's the Conservatives with 130 seats, and you, two parties between you, have way more than that, should the Conservatives still form the government?
Our constitutional form of government says that the first kick goes to the party that has the largest number of seats. That's always been our constitution, and it will continue to be so. That's the British form of constitutional democracy. The one that parliamentary democracy that we have is based on that model.
The first kick, the Conservatives would get to test the House, and then the House would decide?
Well, no, not really, because the NDP is going to be forming the government, because we're going to have the largest number of seats.
Okay, fair enough.
That was Maclean's political editor Paul Wells speaking with NDP leader Thomas Mulcair. For more on the Mulcair interview, go to Maclean's.ca or check out Paul's column in the latest issue of Maclean's magazine.
Earlier this summer, Paul spoke with Liberal leader Justin Trudeau about how his party is preparing for the next election.
I don't spend too much time worrying about what the Conservative strategy is going to be or how much money they're going to spend. I focus on the conversations that we're having with Canadians, the connection that we're building, the trust that the Liberal Party has to rebuild, and the hard work we have to do. And I think that focus, I joke that we'll let my opponents focus on me while I focus on Canadians.
You can find more of that interview with Justin Trudeau on Macleans.ca.
You're listening to Macleans on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Macleans Magazine.
While the opposition is talking about its plans leading up to the next election, we know the economy will be the hot topic for the government. The Harper Conservatives will likely be posting a large surplus in the spring budget after years of deficit spending caused by the Great Recession.
To get to the heart of the government's fiscal plan, Macleans senior writer Anne Kingston has met up with Finance Minister Joe Oliver for a one-on-one interview.
Recently, you've been asked by fiscal conservatives, including those at the C.D. Howe Institute, to delay deficit reduction, to spend to bring down unemployment. People have called for even sizable fiscal shocks to jumpstart labor markets, which are limping along right now. What do you say to them, and what measures is the government taking to stimulate job creation?
We have a $70 billion infrastructure program over the next 10 years. It's the largest and longest infrastructure program in Canadian history. $17 billion will relate to assets under federal jurisdiction, like ports and bridges, and $53 billion will go to the provinces and the municipalities to support projects that they identify. So this is a very important project that we're undertaking with our partners at the municipal and provincial level. And we understand that infrastructure is extraordinarily important. We've got to refurbish crumbling infrastructure, and we've got to build new infrastructure to meet the burgeoning demands of some of our municipalities and rural areas. So we're very much on side on doing that. It's a question of doing it in a fiscally responsible way. We have the good fortune of looking forward to a budgetary surplus next year, $6.4 billion plus a $3 billion contingency. And we therefore are in the happy position of being able to look first to reduce taxes for hardworking Canadians and look at other programs as well. In the meantime, we're committed to increasing transfer payments to the provinces, unlike what the previous government did, where they achieved a surplus on the backs of the provinces. We've increased transfer payments since we got into office by 50%. They totaled $65 billion this year. The province of Ontario alone is receiving $19.2 billion, which is 76% higher than under the previous Liberal government. But we're not going to engage in a reckless spending spree. We work too hard to get to the point where we'll be able to achieve a surplus. So we're going to do it in a fiscally responsible way.
I want to ask you about income splitting. Just before he left the government, Jim Flaherty suggested he no longer supported income splitting, which was a Conservative election promise. When you talk about cutting personal income taxes, are you referring to income splitting specifically? Or if not, what is your position on it?
Well, it's too early to talk specifically about that particular program because, we're at the pre-budget consultation stage. We're going to be talking, as I have been for the last month or so, to Canadians right across the country. And I've identified for Canadians our priority of providing a tax relief. And we're going to be looking at that issue in depth as well as others.
I also want to ask you about the housing market, which is a subject dear to many Canadians. Mm-hmm. Your predecessor voiced concerns about the risks associated with a possible housing bubble, particularly in urban centres, and to also tighten rules for insured mortgages. House prices continue to soar, particularly in cities. Is this a concern of yours? And if so, what is being done about it?
Well, we're certainly watching the mortgage market and the housing market. I would say that prices have moderated somewhat, although in a number of urban centers they continue to rise. We're aware of the fact that consumer debt has gone up. On the other hand, net worth to debt has not, but of course that's a reflection in good part from the higher real estate prices. So we have that very much in mind. It is our intent to continue to reduce the role of the federal government in the mortgage market, but do it very gradually. And we've had a number of moves to moderate the growth of the mortgage market. I mean, as an example, we've decreased the amortization rate from 40 years to 35 to 30 to 25 years. There will not be mortgages granted for homes over $1 million or for second homes. There are certain strict rules regarding credit approval that are in place. And, we don't believe that there is a bubble here. The Bank of Canada doesn't think there is, neither does CMHC.
There's only so much the federal government can do alone. You have to work in concert with the provinces. And on that topic, you recently called Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne's push for $12 billion in infrastructure funding divorced from fiscal reality. And she's become a frequent target in your speeches. Just how difficult is Kathleen Wynne making your job right now?
Well, the first point is that I had to respond to a number of comments she made during the provincial election and subsequent to get the facts out. I mean, there were some allegations about whether we were shortchanging Ontario. That isn't the case. This year, it's $19.2 billion in transfer payments from the federal government, 76% higher than under the previous federal government. We very much want Ontario to prosper and grow. I'm an Ontarian. I have political responsibility for the GTA, and nothing would make me happier than to see Ontario no longer a have-not province, which it has been only since 2009. But when the Premier called for an additional $12 billion in transfers to the province, you know, that would extrapolated to the whole country, mean $30 billion. Well, we're not going to incur $30 billion in debt. And I wanted to make that point fairly clear. We're going to be supportive of the government of Ontario and of all of the provinces going forward. We're going to continue to increase transfer payments for health care, for social welfare, for equalization. Those numbers are going to continue to rise. And we have our $70 billion infrastructure program. But we're not going to be driving this country into another massive deficit.
So is Kathleen Wynne making your life difficult or not right now?
Well, the issue is not whether she's making my life difficult. The issue is whether the fiscal policies are maximizing the growth potential for the country. And, you know, Canada cannot achieve its full potential if its largest province is lagging. So we hope very much that the Premier will follow our example and move at a reasonable speed to a balanced budget.
How would you characterize your relationship with the PMO?
My relationship is workmanlike and just fine.
Workmanlike and fine. So are
you constructive?
Constructive. Are you in constant communication with the PMO? How do you make your decisions autonomously? What influence does the PMO have in the direction of fiscal policy in this country?
Well, you know, I make my own decisions about what I'm going to recommend to the Prime Minister and to Cabinet. The PMO will reflect some of the Prime Minister's priorities. I meet with the Prime Minister regularly, and the PMO is his staff, and so it helps him formulate policy and communicate it. It's a normal sort of process. It's not different than that of any other government, to my knowledge.
I want to ask you also, you've, You came to politics later in your life. You're 74, the oldest finance minister, and by many accounts, one of the most active MPs. But you've also faced ageism, both in the House of Commons and at the Politics in the Pen event earlier this year, where there's sort of jokes from the podium. I'm curious to know, what do you have to say about that? You stood up in the House of Commons and made a comment, but I think that there might be a bigger statement to be made about the sort of reaction that you yourself have faced in government.
Well, look, I don't. I'm going to stand on my own. I think my record will stand on its own, and the Prime Minister had confidence in me to do the position. I mean, I presume he looked at my. At my financial background, and thought that would be relevant. I'd been in cabinet for 3 years. I think just on the issue of age in particular, I think I'm probably at a leading edge demographically in this regard, because the baby boomers are coming up. Say rapidly, but they're coming up, and so I think we're going to see attitudinal change. In this regard, I think what we're going to be more accepting of in the future is the fact that people will be judged on their ability and on their interest, unless with some arbitrary age limit.
That was Maclean senior writer Anne Kingston speaking with Finance Minister Joe Oliver. The two also discussed Oliver's early life and how he got involved in politics. To see Anne's full profile of the minister, pick up the latest issue of Maclean's magazine or head to macleans.ca.
Still to come, the premiers of Ontario, BC, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba weigh in on topics like interprovincial trade, missing and murdered Aboriginal women, and the noticeable absentee from last week's Council of the Federation meeting. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Last week, Canada's premiers gathered in PEI for the 55th Annual Council of the Federation meeting, and Maclean's political editor Paul Wells was there to catch all the action.
On the first day, the premiers joined with First Nations leaders to renew their call for an inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women. The federal government has refused to call one, so the provinces are putting forward a compromise, suggesting a federal-provincial roundtable to discuss new ways to deal with the issue. The Prime Minister is dismissing this, saying these murders are simply crimes, and the problem is being handled by police. But Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall, who is normally on side with the Harper government, isn't buying that.
Well, because I don't quite agree with the Prime Minister. I think that's a big part of it. Mm-hmm. And we've promoted something, whatever we do in terms of an initiative that the provinces and hopefully the feds could join, maybe it's that round table, is that there'd be three phases, and the first piece is around justice. And mm-hmm. maybe, reducing the risks for, hopefully eliminating the risks for these women and girls. But there is a societal element here, and we know that because we've been trying some things in Saskatchewan, and some have worked better than others. But one particular model that's really worked is something we call, for want of a better term, the hub and core method, where we've asked all the local, we haven't asked. We borrowed this from the city of Prince Albert, where the police chief there, and we now have him as a deputy in our government, where he pioneered a process where we literally knocked down the silos between all the agencies that deal with people in vulnerable positions, at-risk folks in Prince Albert, social services, education, the health region, the police force, and they were able to identify that from frontline input, including in education, identify those at-risk people and get ahead of challenges. And it has worked. In fact, we're exporting it to North Battleford, and Yorkton's going to be next. That's why we hired the deputy away from the city of Prince Albert as our deputy minister. Well, that's not just the crime piece. There's other elements there. Yeah. Finally, the third phase is responsibility. I would like to hear, and I know this will be the case, but I'd like to see a process that focused on Aboriginal responsibility, right at the grassroots, bands and councils, dads. What are we doing, especially when you consider that 43% of the violence against Aboriginal women comes from someone in the family, a spouse usually, someone close, family and friends. Mm-hmm. So those are the three phases we'd like to see, and I think the Prime Minister has one of them, but I think there's other things.
Now, another big issue discussed at the meeting was internal trade and breaking down the barriers of shipping goods from one province to another. The Western Bloc of provinces did eke out a minor deal, but there was no grand agreement. Manitoba's Greg Selinger doesn't see it as a bad thing, though, because the provinces will continue to work on this issue.
We agreed as a group of premiers to have a comprehensive renewal of our agreement on internal trade. Clearly, we want to do more business with each other. It's grown by about 60% between 2002-2012, consonant with growth in the economy. So we're not just saying it's all because of us, but it has grown. We think there's things we can do to address issues. Labor mobility, there's a lot of progress been made on that. But there's other areas where we can make further progress, particularly with skilled trades. We think we can harmonize some of the regs there and how you get credit for the hours you worked, et cetera. But we're also going to take a look at government procurement, goods, services, investment, regulatory cooperation, and technical barriers. So there's going to be a focus on some key areas, and then we'll move on from there. But I think it's a positive movement.
Meanwhile, Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne led the charge in calling on the federal government for more health care funding, given the aging demographic of our country.
That was an interesting discussion. There wasn't unanimity on the mechanism. Mm-hmm. We all agreed that we've got an aging demographic, even in Alberta and Saskatchewan that have the youngest populations. They still have an aging population overall. And so we're all struggling with how best to provide the service that people need and where they need it. And so Christy Clark had a particular suggestion about a fund, and that idea has been given to the Fiscal Arrangements Working Group to talk about, because it's part of the context of that fiscal imbalance between the federal government, whose reality is that they're going to be in surplus within a year or so, and the provincial realities, which is many of us are still in deficit. And so we need to have an arrangement that is fair.
Now, after this meeting, all premiers agreed it went more smoothly this year, and they're crediting that to newcomer Philippe Couillard from Quebec. Each premier says it was much easier to deal with a federalist than a separatist leader because Couillard has many common concerns and wants to improve the quality of life not only in Quebec but all of Canada. But as the premiers welcomed someone new, they also pointed out the absence of one important politician. BC's Christy Clark says it would have been great to see Prime Minister Stephen Harper.
I hope he notices how committed we are to, and all Canadians notice, how committed we are to internal trade, to knocking down those internal trade barriers across the country, and how committed we are to working together on things like healthcare, finding multi-million, hundred millions of dollars worth of savings in healthcare through efficiencies. Areas of our jurisdiction where we can do something, we're committed to coming together and doing that. Mm-hmm. Having said that, we also need a partner. Two-thirds of the taxes in this country are collected by the federal government versus the provincial governments. Yeah. And 80% of the programs are delivered by the provincial versus the federal. They need to be a partner. They need to decide they want to be an active partner in building Canada. And that's, I hope, the other part that they'll see in this. Healthcare, infrastructure, those things are really important for our country now, and they've got to invest.
For more of Paul Wells' coverage of the Premier's meeting, head to macleans.ca. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.